Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Sunday Brunch here on Monocle 24 with me, Paul Osborne. Coming up this week, we'll discuss Maori literature as a major exhibition of art from the Pacific region is staged in London. We'll take in an indie festival in Paris. And also,
femininity is a strength, not a weakness. Being a woman or being feminine is not a burden to be overcome. Actually, it makes us incredibly powerful.
We'll explore how to break the stereotypes that still plague women. We'll take a look through the weekend's newspapers as well. Plus,
I think it's time we give tea a chance. I think coffee is really popular. I do like coffee, but I think tea has more benefits.
We'll look at the ethical tea business that's hoping to shake up the industry. All that in the next hour on Sunday Brunch, live from London on Monocle 24. So, good morning. Welcome to today's Sunday Brunch. As we join you on air here in London, there are dozens of world leaders at the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. That is the main focal point for the commemorations of the 100th anniversary of the signing of the armistice to end the First World War. Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump joining Emmanuel Macron at that event. The big event here in London happens 1 hour later at the Cenotaph. But that is part of a day-long series of events. We'll reflect on that when we look through the weekend's newspapers a little later in this hour. And it is all over the front page of the papers. Big photograph pop is on the front page of The Observer, a supplement in the Sunday Times, and a really interesting, powerful picture on the front of the Sunday Telegraph of a silhouette of a soldier wearing a poppy projected onto the side of a castle. We'll go through all that a little bit later in this hour. But first, today, it is perhaps hard to believe that an exhibition currently underway in London is the first ever in the UK to be a large-scale presentation of art from New Zealand and other territories that will be grouped under the heading of Oceania. There are around 200 works on display at the Royal Academy from places including Polynesia and Micronesia. And alongside that exhibition, five leading Maori and Pacific writers are in the UK to showcase their work, and I'm delighted to say two of them are with me in the studio this morning. Carla Miller is a Pacific poet of Tongan, Samoan and Palangi heritage. Paula Morris is a writer whose latest book explores the subject of secret histories. Thank you both very much for coming in this morning. Carla, it is extraordinary to think that no one had previously thought that the art and culture of this region was worthy of a major exhibition in London.
Well, what was particularly sad is that some of these objects that are beloved through pictures at home actually just spend all their time in cupboards at the British Museum, and it's the first time they've been out. So that makes me, it made me a bit weepy, actually. These are defining, iconic.
So they've all been, a lot, all of them, but a lot of them have been here in the UK and they've just been in a storeroom somewhere.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a particular piece called A'a, and there's an etching of the missionary who brought them over as kind of missionary brides, they were considered to be, and he's standing there with his foot on top of one of the demigods and they're all kind of rolling around the deck. And then they made their way into a cupboard in the British Museum, and it's the first time for us to see them in the flesh, so to speak. So they've got quite a history behind them.
Well, I want to explore that a little bit later. Paula, you describe yourself as a New Zealander at large, and I know that you spent a lot of your time away from New Zealand. So it must be interesting, firstly, in the terms of this exhibition, seeing all of this art in the context of being on the other side of the world.
Yes, I lived away, and mainly in the UK and the US, for almost 30 years. And now I'm back in New Zealand. It's quite interesting, the thing of the clashing perspectives, and to realise how little is really known about New Zealand beyond the sort of very obvious sort of quite colonial tropes. And one of the most impressive things about the Oceania exhibition is the first room you enter has a massive map with the Pacific at its centre and all the islands picked out. And the countries that people often think of, especially when they use that awful term Pacific Rim, like, you know, North and South America, Australia, Japan, etc., they are very much peripheral on that map. And you get this really strong notion of a vast sea full of islands. And then the suggestions of the riches of the cultures and the relationships in that place that otherwise get completely overlooked all the time.
I know that a few years ago now, there was an exhibition at the Royal Academy of Art from Australia. And I think that there's obviously, there's always been a sort of connection between the UK and Australia. And there's, I don't know anybody in the UK who doesn't know somebody who moved to Australia or was six generations ago or something. And but it's almost as if having made the journey that far from London, say, to Sydney, there's then a reluctance to go any further than Australia.
Well, one thing we've been discussing this week at the Royal Academy and at other events we've been doing is how difficult it is for people who lack cultural context and understandings to really encounter it and interpret it. So much of the art is impenetrable to people, perhaps, unless they're willing to make a little bit of effort and maybe use the free audio guide at the RA. But to understand the riches of the stories and the narratives and the cultures behind the work, whereas maybe people think that they have a better handle on what's going on in Australia, whether that's true or not. So it's asking people, people who visit the exhibition, to really push themselves in terms of their knowledge and understanding of a region and its incredible diversity, but also, as I said, its relationships, its cultural relationships and influences, because these people were the greatest of voyagers.
And I know that that notion of voyaging is one of the key themes in the exhibition. I suppose there's a sense, isn't there, that you perceive from the UK this as being that people from Europe set out to other parts of the world and basically just stole things from other cultures. But one thing that comes across from this is that cultural exchange goes both ways, that you can then see the influence of the work from that region has an influence on art that is produced in Europe, or not, as the case may be.
Well, no, I mean, Gauguin famously came to New Zealand on his way to Tahiti, went to what was then the Auckland Museum and saw a lot of Maori art. And then you see him playing that out in his work when he's living in Tahiti and the Marquesas. And then it's returned to Europe in the form, like so many of his generation, of primitive art and the influence of primitive art. But one of the questions we've been asking is, why is one culture's mythology and approach to art considered primitive versus sophisticated? And that's, I think, one of the challenges of the exhibition, to say, actually look at the sophisticated richness and layers of meaning in this work, that it doesn't need to be translated by Europeans. It needs a different sort of immersion, and it requires an imaginative leap and an intellectual leap from people. It requires curiosity. And sometimes it's just not packaged in the most palatable way, maybe.
Which is a challenge. It doesn't excuse a major institution or city or country even ignoring the culture of a whole other part of the world. But I suppose that's one of the challenges. You'd say, well, it's too hard to explain this to an audience in London.
And also, I mean, we're still very much within the English-speaking world in a colonial mindset, I think, where we still really, when I say we, I don't actually mean we at all, but where there's a perception of London and New York as the tastemakers, as the originators, as the centres, where, of course, that's really meaningless to people away from those centres, even within Britain, as you know, but in other places as well. So in the Southern Hemisphere, we have a lot of conversations going on and relationships that don't involve looking north constantly. And it's, I suppose the Oceania exhibition is asking people to look south and to understand the vastness and complexity of what's there, rather than imagine that everything must be easy and palatable. I mean, it's very good of you to interview us. We were offered to other people to interview, and one of the responses to us coming here was that we were too niche, which is very interesting if you think we're coming here as representatives of the greatest ocean on Earth.
Well, I'm not going to ask you on air. I'm definitely going to ask you off air who said that. One of the things that's happening as part of this event is that they've asked each of you to choose an artwork mm-hmm. as a starting point.
Yes.
So how did you go about making that choice?
Well, I broke all the rules like a typical Tongan woman, and I chose 11. And then I went back and I wrote about 5 more poems. And in the end, my longest poem was about an image that wasn't even able to be photographed, actually, because we had the images up on the wall. And that was a human skull from West Papua. And it was the one object that I didn't even notice it the first time around, actually. And then I guess I had the most visceral reaction to, especially because of what's happening in West Papua.
Which is, for people who don't know?
Well, some people use the word, in my poem, exactly, the G word, genocide. So it's considered, and I'm doing inverted commas here, a kind of distant part of Indonesia. But it's actually, it's half, Papua New Guinea, it's a country cut in half, and Papua New Guinea's on one side, West Papua's on the other. And I'm quite, there's a huge free West Papua movement happening, and it's just something that's so politically difficult that most of the Pacific just don't even want to think about it, contend with it, talk about it. It's very inconvenient. So I thought it was quite appropriate, actually, that it was Skull that was presented there. And turning away from West Papua death is something that is happening on an oceanic scale, so to speak. So,
does that speak to something that I think that you mentioned, Paul, a moment ago, that idea of two cultures in the West, Europe, say, or America, the barrier or a barrier that stops them from engaging with this is they think this is all too different. This is too far away and too complex for me to get a handle on. That we talked about Australia before, and that, you know, because Australia, so much of the culture seems to look at either Britain or America. Certainly in popular culture, there's an awful lot drawn from both. That when you then take the next step to a country that has its own completely different culture, they just find it a bit harder to engage with it.
Have you been to New Zealand?
I haven't.
You should come. Come
up once. It's very English speaking. It's very much like if you go to the Cotswolds, someone said, go to the Cotswolds, it'll be amazing to you. I just felt like I was driving through New Zealand. I was just like, I'm not understanding this. How is this a World Heritage Park? I feel like I'm driving between Palmerston North and Wellington.
It does have older buildings in the Cotswolds, I would venture.
Yeah, I guess it's just that we very strongly draw so many influences, including our form of government and the majority of the settler culture, from here. So it's not really that different at all. But what's being celebrated, I guess, in the Oceania exhibition is the fragments of all the Indigenous cultures that have survived colonisation in cupboards somewhere far from home.
And I would argue, of course, that in New Zealand, where one of our official languages is Te Reo Māori, that I think some people over here might think, oh, I'll move to New Zealand because it's a bit warmer than here and I can live by a beach and I can speak English, don't realise the importance of Māori culture, the centrality of it within New Zealand government and institutions and within our society. And they don't understand that they're moving to the South Pacific. I wonder if there's just been in the past a tendency to exoticise the South Pacific and to make it seem this very bland place, you know, free of conflict, that involves, you know, empty beaches and palm trees and friendly natives. And actually the natives, they can be friendly, but also often we're quite annoyed. And there's
Paula's proof, living proof.
Just a really annoyed native. And that there are lots of big social and political issues that everyone is dealing with in the Pacific, from climate change to issues of equity and in New Zealand, disproportionate imprisonment of Māori and Pacifica people. So we have many darknesses, many shadows on that sparkling blue ocean, as everywhere does, right? As every culture does. You have the things that are strong about you and appealing, and other things that are dark and difficult. And I think the Oceania exhibition speaks to a lot of that, but it does require people not to just see it as an exhibition they wander through thinking how beautiful things are.
As a tiki tour.
Yeah, exactly.
As a tiki tour, I think. But as poets, it's kind of our job to dig around in those dark shadows. So,
What reaction have you had so far from people?
Well, at the evening at the Royal Academy, we almost got a standing ovation. It was packed. They ran out of extra seating and then they had to just get ordinary chairs from places. And I think that clapping just, I would say, went on for minutes.
We were all a bit embarrassed, really. Yeah. It was like, well, you're still clapping. What are we supposed to do?
I know. So it did. It did. It was a lovely, lovely night. And it was kind of odd because, you know, we'd been told that Darwin had given his speech on the origin of the species in that very room. And so, yeah, it was an interesting place for us to be putting our voices into.
It's fascinating. The exhibition is still at the Royal Academy here in London. Kalamila Pormarsh, thank you both very much for coming in this morning.
Kia ora.
Still to come this morning, we're going to be looking at how you change the tea industry. We'll take a leaf through the weekend's newspapers too, and in just a moment, we're off to Paris.
Stay one step ahead of the breaking news.
People are saying, look, enough is enough. The middle class is getting squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. The rich are getting richer. And they're saying, look, this is not a fair game.
Hear industry-leading insights from our experts.
When tech companies have problems, they can go south very quickly. BlackBerry, Nokia, nowhere near the companies they used to be, but both were invincible. Nokia boasted that they were one of the first companies on the planet to sell 1 billion of their products.
And catch up with Monocle's Bureau around the world. Every weekday at noon London time, keep your appointment with The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Paris next, which is the venue for the Pitchfork Music Festival. It aims to showcase the best international music from what you might loosely call the indie scene. Monocle's Paige Reynolds was there and sent this report.
Now in its eighth year running, Music Festival Pitchfork Paris is no longer just the European extension of the influential Chicago-based online music magazine, but has become its own unique entity. With a loyal fan base that includes Parisian locals and international culture fanatics, festival-goers are treated to performances from both new and established acts in the impressive Grande Halle de la Villette to the north of the city. To complement the main festival, 2016 saw the addition of Pitchfork Avant-Garde, a spin-off festival where a selection of rising international artists and new talent are given the chance to warm up the crowd in venues sprawled across Paris. Last weekend, just as the main event was kicking off, Monocle sat down with festival director Julien Catala. He started by telling us how this festival came across the Atlantic.
I know Ryan and Chris from Pitchfork since a long, long time. And I always wanted to bring the festival here. So they came here a few times, 8 years ago when we started it. And I think they always loved Paris because it's a beautiful city. And at this time in Paris, we didn't have festival like Pitchfork, like bringing international crowd and discovering new artists. So it was interesting to combine our forces and do a Pitchfork festival in Paris. I think what is interesting is that 8 years ago, a lot of people were coming because it was Pitchfork and because they knew Pitchfork, but now a lot of people just come to the festival to discover music, to discover. We have a lot of European artists as well, and the website talks a lot more maybe about American artists. So there was a lot of European crowd who wants to discover all these bands, so people come actually for the festival itself, and that's interesting, I think.
What was your best year, I suppose, in terms of lineup or acts that you didn't think were going to pull through and then they did?
I think one year we were supposed to have Björk, and she cancelled maybe 3 months before the festival because she was not well, she was sick. And it was very difficult to her, but we talked to Tom York's manager, and Tom York were very excited to play and replace Björk. So we had Tom York, we had Jamie XX at this time as well, we had Fortet, and we had Beach House as well this year. And we were so worried 3 months before because Björk had cancelled and it would be awful. And finally, it was the best year of the festival. So maybe that was one of my favorites. I think the venue, it's really beautiful. You know, it was made by Gustave Eiffel, so the guy who made Eiffel Tower. That's why it's so beautiful. Like, it's really unique. You can't see a building like that in another city than Paris. So that's the first thing. So the capacity is quite small for a festival. So we do 7,000 capacity a day. So it's like a boutique festival. I think that's why artists want to play here. Also, we take a lot of care of the light production, of the sound production, and it's quite an elegant festival. I think the artists usually really like that. It.
One final question: when you were sort of making this festival, did you
did you have any other festivals that you wanted to try and replicate what they were doing? So did you ever go to a festival and think, yes, this is how we want to run it, or are there festivals now that you think we could take some tips from them?
Obviously, I like some festivals, like I like Field Day in London. I like Primavera in Barcelona. But I think Field Day is perfect for London. Primavera can't be only in Barcelona, but Paris, it's special. Like the French audience is very difficult to please. I would like to say it's completely. Like everybody's, it's a bit snobby here, but in a bad way, but in a good way as well. So we really needed to create something properly French. So I think this is, of course, it's called Pitchfork, and there is all this American bands playing here, but I think it's a proper French festival as well. So it was what we wanted to do, something really for Paris.
One of several up-and-coming French acts on this year's lineup was 21-year-old Louis Hoffman, a producer, composer and artist in his own right, who skillfully merges classic disco beats with soaring melodies that you'd struggle to sit still to. Monocle's Hester Underhill slipped backstage shortly after his set to find out a little more about the young musician.
I really love this festival because it's really clean, you know.
Yeah.
It's really like for like kind of mature projects. That's why I feel blessed, you know, to be here. I worked a lot, you know, before the show. I have to be like and that's why I was like really confident. You know, like yesterday I did like rehearsal for like all the day, you know.
Yeah,
I
felt ready.
A bit of whiskey cola, you know.
So how long have you been doing music for? Did you study music?
Actually, I start music to really like, you know, compose my own song. It was like maybe 6-7 years ago. I was still like it's high school. I was just doing my thing, and you know, like my dream was that the girls from my school, I was saying no one that I was doing my music composing. And then I was like, okay, I need to do some real things. So I got like audio interface, you know, a good computer, whatever, you know, software. And that's, you know, cool. I made my first official EP, so it's Yo Bene.
Yeah.
And you know, time goes by and everything.
Yeah.
And
now. So how would you describe your music to someone who's never listened to it before?
So for me, what I love the most in music is the melody and the groove. And this is, for me, in the composition process, like the most important. And I know, like, I put all my energy in the melody and the groove, so I like to call my music melodic groove. That's how I call it, you know. So, I think it's good to listen to my music in this mood, you know, say, okay, I'm going to listen to melodic groove.
And who are your biggest influences, would you say?
Actually, my biggest influence is a bunch of guys, it's all the Italian composers from the 70s. All this music was made by, like, you know, real composers.
Mm.
So really, like, into melody and everything. And this is the most beautiful music you could ever listen to.
Louis Hoffman is one of a number of French acts who took the stage at this year's festival. And Pitchfork's curation of homegrown artists alongside international names makes for a refreshing lineup, and is one of the many reasons Pitchfork continues to lead the charge in the boutique festival calendar. Playing us out is Louis Hoffman's dreamy disco ballad, Je Pense à Toi. From Pitchfork Paris, we've been Paige Reynolds and Hester Underhill. Until next year.
Well, let's turn our attention away from music now to literature. You're listening to Sunday Brunch on Monocle 24. Because it's time now for our weekend read, and this week Georgina Godwin speaks to Rachel Pashley, who has spent the last 5 years analysing a survey of more than 8,000 women across the world. That's fed into a new book, which is called New Female Tribes, Shattering Female Stereotypes and Redefining Women. And she explained more about her findings when she spoke to Georgina.
Basically, what we wanted to do was study contemporary femininity and what it meant to be a woman today. So we explored everything from career and ambition to love and relationships, through to education, attitudes towards technology, family, you know, aspirations. And I think the results were incredible. And a lot of things emerged that were quite surprising, but also that gave me a lot of optimism about what it is to be a woman today.
Mm. 76% of women globally felt it had never been a better time to be a woman.
That's right. And also in some places where you might not think you wake up every morning and think, yay, I'm a woman. I'm on top of the world. Which was, it was quite heartening in that there is so much optimism amongst women, but also so much ambition and drive.
Mm. Well, speaking of ambition and drive, 74% of all women surveyed felt that work was linked to their sense of self. That's something I can totally relate to.
Yes. Yes, likewise. And what we noticed as well was that was, if anything, slightly stronger amongst women who were mums versus women who were sort of pre-children or didn't have children. And equally, we saw that sense of ambition across all countries. What we noticed was almost a universality of alpha characteristics. And what I mean by that, say women saying they're defined by their career, they want to get to the top of their career, they feel very proud to be a breadwinner, proud to provide for their family. And that was, it peaked, if anything, amongst women in countries like the Middle East, say Saudi Arabia.
Where one expects women to be oppressed and not have those attitudes.
Exactly. And equally, when we ask women to define femininity, the values of femininity, contemporary femininity, were confidence, independence, in the Middle East, fearlessness and independence. So those are the qualities of leadership. They're not the qualities of pretty passivity. And women in India were the most confident of being successful in life. And if anything, the most alpha. Again, surprising and confounding some of our sort of Western stereotypes of what it is to be a woman in these countries.
So I guess in the Middle East, if women are put down and held back by the patriarchy, what it means is that their feelings to go forward are just even stronger than we in the West who have that freedom.
I think so. And I think it's also important to sort of overlay their own cultural perceptions. So, you know, there are a significant number of women in Saudi Arabia who oppose the lifting of the driving ban for all those who were sort of trying to push it through. I think it's very easy to make sort of judgments about what it is to be emancipated in these countries. But what we observe, again, you know, working with our Middle East tribes team, is that women in the Middle East are hugely entrepreneurial and highly educated as well. And again, you know, it sort of stamps out the myth that all women do is go mall shopping in these countries.
You put people roughly into four tribes, although you're very clear to point out we're all part of all of them in some way. But broadly speaking, we're talking about alphas that you've already spoken about, women for whom work is very important. Hedonists, traditionalists and altruists. Just explore those for me a little.
So we had four master tribes, and within those there are a greater number of more nuanced tribes. So there's over more than 20 or 25 individual tribes. But those master tribes look at the dimensions that motivate us most. So are you self-focused? So alphas and hedonists are a great example of being very self-focused. Or are you focused on the needs of others? So again, we look at altruists or traditionalists who are focused on the needs of others. And then the dimension of, you know, what's your aspiration or motivation? Are you seeking enjoyment? So again, hedonists are self-focused and it's all about pleasure. Or are you achievement-focused? And alphas are self-focused, but they're all about sort of achievement and drive. And so we use those dimensions to separate those sort of master tribes, the sort of basic fundamentals of what gets us out of bed every morning. And I think for me, reporting the existence of hedonists felt very, very important, because hedonism is not something that women are really given permission to explore. You know, when was the last time you watched a film and saw women sort of kicking back on the sofa, being lazy, drinking beer? I've lost count of the number of times I see men in that role. But if women are lazy in a film, they're often punished for it. You know, she's often got to, you know, she'll be guiltily eating chocolate, but somehow her character is made to pay for it in the end. Or, you know, she may be seen to be neglecting her family. But again, the narrative will be that she sees the error of her ways.
And she'll almost always be unattractive.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Or she'll be greedy. It'll be very much disparaging if she's perceived to be looking after herself.
Mm.
And I think the idea that women are increasingly, you know, being independent and confident in pursuing their own wants and needs. That feels really important to talk about, and in the marketing industry, incredibly important for, say, the luxury categories or automotive.
Mm. Now, this book has obviously been in the works for a long time, yeah. So significantly before Me Too and Time's Up. Yeah. But certainly those movements must have helped increase the dialogue around women's roles in modern society.
Absolutely. And I also, we observed within our study the rise of activism amongst women. And the social pioneers are one tribe within the altruists. And these are women who want to change the world for the better. And that could be, you know, on the world stage or political stage, or it could be at a community level. And we observed that those are in high existence in places like Brazil, where, you know, you get alpha females, but often they want to take the community with them. They want to share that success as they climb the ladder. And I think it's almost hardwired into us as women. We do tend to think outwards, and we want to share our successes and good fortunes.
Mm. And then, of course, there are the traditionalists.
Yes. Yeah, and I think those were very prevalent, actually, in America, particularly, you know, outside of the metropolitan areas. And I think it very much explains, you know, the rise of sort of Trumpism, a return to traditional values. And of course, you've got the preponderance of the sort of evangelical church in the US as well, which underlines those traditional values.
Quite extraordinary that this, when you think of this from the perspective of a modern woman, yes, that this is something that still drives many women in the world.
I think it is. And I think feminism takes all shapes and forms. And for me, I'm very keen to, you know, I ascribe to the belief that there's not one script of what makes a good or bad feminist. And actually, you know, some women, I've got very good friends, and for whom the drive to have children, you know, overrode everything else in life. And, you know, if that's what you want to do, good for you, you know, all power to you. And I think you can still be a feminist and be, you know, a great nurturer and want to, you know, devote your life to bringing up children, or, you know, making the home that your entire focus.
Mm. What for you is the main thing that came out of this, and what will be its use in your industry?
I think for me, one of the things, or one of the key findings, was, like I say, this, the definition of contemporary femininity was hardwired with these alpha characteristics. It was the qualities of leadership. And actually, femininity is a strength, not a weakness. Being a woman or being feminine is not a burden to be overcome. Actually, it makes us incredibly powerful. It gives us great strength and capabilities. And I think, you know, what I term female capital, the value that women bring to the world, is immense. And as a woman, you know, I want women to embrace their female capital in all its shapes and forms. You know, the fact is, you don't have to sort of act like a man or be as good as a man, you know, use sort of male success as some kind of benchmark in order to get on in life. Mm. And I think embracing one's own femininity and female capital is powerful. And I hope women feel free to do that.
That's Rachel Pashley speaking there to Georgina Gobbin and her book, which is called New Female Tribe, Shattering Female Stereotypes and Redefining Women Today, is out now. Stay with us. We'll go through the weekend's papers in just a moment.
The rolling hills of Somerset might not be the most usual spot for a world-class art space, but it proved to be the perfect fit for Houser & Worth, an international art gallery with its heart in the countryside. Monocle Films reviews a weird and wonderful show that looks at our relationship with the land.
We used to base our knowledge, our experience of the world, on the land, on nature, on the other beings that shared the world. Now we don't. So I'm trying to, in a way, re-establish a relationship to a form of knowledge that could be useful for us.
Somerset's Strange Fruit, playing now in the film section at monocle.com.
Well, let's take a look now through some of the stories in the weekend's newspapers. My guest in the studio, Cornelia Mayer, is the CEO of Mayer Resources, which is a business consultancy. Thank you for coming in this morning.
And she's struggling with the, your guests are struggling with
yes. They're not looking at the. Do you know what? Let's just take them off. We don't need them. Let's just pretend they're not there. Our headphones, it is fair to say, are a bit of a challenge in the studio sometimes. I mentioned at the start of the programme this morning that all of the newspapers, obviously marking the centenary of the signing of the armistice. As we came on air, the main event was happening in Paris. As we talk now, we're 20 or so minutes away from the main event here in London.
And
this, of course,
2 minutes of silence in London as well.
2 minutes of silence, and this, of course, at the end of a 4-year process of commemorating all these different milestones through the First World War, leading up to this, and the newspapers obviously all talking about this. And indeed, you've written a piece that talks about this as well.
Yeah, I have written a piece in which I sort of weave in Arab News, which says, what have we learned? And what I deploy there is that after the Second World War, we have signed the Geneva Convention, and everybody seems now to just not look at the Geneva Convention anymore. And the Geneva Convention affords rights to the civilian population caught up in warfare, also affords rights to prisoners of war. But the former is really, really important. And, you know, the more wars we have, the more we see the civilian population who is hurting. In the First World War, we saw 1/3 of the dead. And were soldiers, were civilians. 2/3 were soldiers. In Second World War, that ratio of non-combatants to combatants doubled, and it's increasing ever with new technologies.
And you see it in conflicts like Yemen today.
You see it in Yemen. You see it in Syria. You see it also when you look at Iraq and Afghanistan. The people really still hurting is the civilian population. But here, I looked at a very moving tribute to four brothers who lost their lives in the Observer, a century on their great-grandchildren. It's a whole family of where all the sons basically got annihilated, four brothers, and the great-grandsons and great-granddaughters are now commemorating the Armistice Day, which is a very touching tribute. I then turned over to the French because they had, as you said, they had the big meeting today, or the big celebration today, where they had 60 heads of state, which is a lot of heads of state, and dignitaries commemorating. Yesterday we had a moving picture with President Macron and Merkel and Chancellor Merkel, which was about as moving as the one when we saw Chancellor in 1984, Chancellor Kohl and Mitterrand commemorating again. I thought that was Second World War together, but it was very moving. Macron asks, whatever happened, we said, we never want this again. So in the same vein as my article, he said, but we keep on having wars. The one thing that I thought was a little bit deplorable was that President Trump couldn't be bothered going to the American cemetery yesterday. He sent Jim Mattis and Danford, his chief of staff. He couldn't be bothered because it was raining and the helicopter wouldn't fly.
What's extraordinary about it? I mean, there's a limit to how many times you can be outraged by things that Donald Trump does. But what's during the midterms, you know, campaign, when people said, you know, why is he doing all these terrible things? Why is he saying all these terrible things? And people pointed out he's doing and saying them because his base like it and respond to it. But you would think if there was one thing that Donald Trump could do that would offend and alienate his own base supporters, it would be to be seen to be disrespectful to veterans of a major conflict.
Yes, but it's happened in Europe. He would never have that happen to him in the United States. If this was the Arlington Cemetery or something like that, it wouldn't have happened. It was in Europe, and you know which brings us to the next piece, actually, which is again Le Monde, the U.S. is divorcing Europe, and it's actually quite an interesting piece we saw in the run-up to the Armistice Day celebration. Donald Trump flew into Paris, and the first thing he did was tweet that he thought it was disrespectful for Macron to suggest we have a European army while he disengages from NATO, which is quite interesting. And he says, look, it's not just this piece says Trump doesn't get Europe, but he's not the first one who doesn't get Europe. It talks about all the Baltic states who went to Washington, all the heads of Baltic states to commemorate in 1991 having been able to throw off the shackles of communism. And the first thing Trump did was tell them off because there had been all this warfare in the Balkans. It took him some time to understand that the Balkans were not quite the Baltics. So that's the level of understanding, it seems. But it then goes on and says, look, a disengagement has started with Obama already because he saw what happened under Bush with the engagement in Iraq and Afghanistan. But at the same time, you know, he was more leading from the back. But now we just see an increased aggravation, and we see this leading to a divorce between Europe and the United States in terms of trade, but more crucially also in terms of what's happening with NATO.
Well, talking about people who don't understand Europe, let's move on to Brexit.
Yes, but I would say this is starting to be madder than a box of frogs on hallucinants.
every week for the last 2 months now, someone has said to me, this is it, this is the pivotal week. Going to be presented with the final deal and there will be an open revolt in the cabinet and she won't be prime minister by the end of the week. And then you get to the weekend and somebody then says, yeah, we're not quite there yet.
Yeah, and when you look at the Times, it's actually quite interesting because they start off with a piece which sort of says what has happened, and she is proposing a Brexit deal where the interim arrangements on trade, she wanted an independent mechanism to conflict resolution mechanism, and end of last week the EU came out and said no such thing. If you want conflict resolution, there is the ECJ. And there is only the ECJ.
Which is one of the institutions that she says we don't want to
exactly.
be part
we want to take our laws back. Then also you had four cabinet ranking people resign. Most, the transport secretary, the brother of Boris Johnson, has resigned, and he called what's happening here a failure of British statecraft on a scale not seen on a scale since the Suez Crisis. So he and his brother are both very good with words, very clearly. It criticises Graham Brady, who's the chairman of the 1922 committee, which is the people who can actually have a vote of no confidence. He had enough letters in summer and didn't do anything. So on page 14, they say, Mrs May, we have a problem, and they sort of liken Brexit on landing a defunct craft on the surface of Moon, which is quite interesting. You have the very, very well-written piece by Sir Keir Starmer, the shadow Brexit secretary, Labour, who basically says, look, we don't know where this is going, and you cannot expect people to sign up onto anything that, you know, where we're left in limbo land. He says no government has the right to plunge the country into chaos because of its own failure. The national interest must come first.
Which would be fine if the leader of his party hadn't explicitly over the last few days in an interview in Der Spiegel and again in television and radio interviews, just when asked, you know, what are you going to do to stop Brexit, has said nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're all equally guilty. But where Keir Starmer has a point is, he says, the government has not consulted with Labour. The government has not asked for opinions. He also says, you know, a lot of the Brexit negotiations were less about how do we negotiate with the Europeans. It was more how can I negotiate a deal such that my government doesn't fall apart, which surely can't be the case. He makes one point that I disagree with when he says, I agree with it. He says, if we don't have anything by end of November, we won't have enough time to pass it through to Parliament. That's all right and good. But nobody thinks that this thing, whatever the final agreement looks like, has to go through the European Parliament and through 27 other governments. I mean, you know, yes, we are the ones leaving, but we are not the only ones affected here.
And we know that the other 27 have been saying in meetings in Brussels that they are just as worried as a lot of the British ministers are, that they're going to be presented with something that they're not going to have time to scrutinise and they're not going to be able to work through.
And you saw Michel Barnier write the Brexit negotiator on behalf of the EU. Right from the way go, he said, I need 6 months to pass this through 27 parliaments. Well, he now has 3 months.
We're very nearly out of time, but let's just lastly go back to the armistice and the end of the First World War, another piece in the Sunday Telegraph.
Yeah, which is a very, very touching piece. Again, it's a man who, of Pakistani origin, Asif Shakur, whose grandfather, Mohammed Gama, has been awarded two medals, who were sort of sold off, and are one of them he has been able to trace back and buy back, and he is trying to find the second medal of his ancestor, and he's willing to pay, I think, £250 for anybody who finds it and then buy it back.
Good Lord. I mean, this is the thing, isn't it? Is that what I think the last 4 years has brought back is that everyone has one of these. I'm just looking now this world that you have all your photographs carrying around with you. The oldest photograph I have stored in my cloud is from the 1st of March, 1917. It is of my... It must be my great grandfather in his uniform on a trip back from the Western Front. This is the thing, everybody, the generation that fought in that war's gone.
But is why I found this piece in the Observer so striking, because it really brought it back that every single family in this country
Everyone has a story. Everyone was affected. Cornelia, thank you very much. You're listening to Sunday Brunch from Monocle 24. We're going to end by talking about one of my favourite topics, which is tea, because most tea providers get their supplies from a variety of producers and then blend it. But Tetulia gets it all from one garden in Bangladesh. It's fully sustainable and organic. It was founded by Ashan Akbar, who brought some samples in when he came to meet Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Every tea is hand-picked, organic, single origin. We can trace back to exactly who picked the leaves, the women who are behind the garden. And then they're shipment time is actually 3 days. We are doing air freight. So the tea you're having in front of you was produced in August. We received them in September and now it's October. So it's as fresh as it gets. I think that's very important for the robustness and the complexity of tea flavors to get all the different notes. It needs to be fresh. I think it's time we give tea a chance. I think coffee is really popular. I do like coffee, but I think tea has more benefits.
Do you think that's important to know, you know, the provenance of the ingredients?
I think it's hugely important. And I find it fascinating how people are obsessed. The coffee aficionados are very obsessed with the single origin of coffee. So where in Colombia is it from? Is it ethically sourced? Is it fair trade? All of those questions come in. I think the same question should be applied to tea as well. And a lot of the tea you find in the UK are actually sourced from gardens which do not follow many international rules which should be followed, like labor rights, decent wage, looking after the people who are actually in the garden working for you. So we started this garden in 2000, so we are a fairly new garden. Generally, gardens are hundreds of years old, especially in the subcontinent. We are only 18 years old. So that gives a nice sort of complexity to our flavors. It's very new. Secondly, everything in the garden is organic. So we use no chemicals, no pesticides. And we follow the philosophy of the Japanese philosopher, Masanobu Fukuoka, the non-invasive farming. So we don't actually water our tea plants. So minimal amount of intervention. So we fertilize the ground very well. So the tea just grows naturally. We believe in that natural farming method. And we really think that having chemicals and having pesticides in this day and age is just wrong. And in terms of the provenance, I think the tea you find here is blended. So it's good crop with less good crop blended and you get a flavor. Like fine wine, if you can tell that this is coming just from one garden, you'll find if you have a bad crop, we won't be able to sell it, basically. So every year we have to make sure the plants are actually producing good leaves. And it is only then we can bring it here. So for example, this year I wanted to bring some Earl Grey, which is very popular in the UK. But the quality of bergamot that we grew there, which is required for Earl Grey, wasn't good enough. So right now I only have 6 different types of loose leaf teas, which are all fantastic, but Earl Grey wasn't good enough to be brought to the UK. Next year, I'll try again if the crop is good. So I think that's very important. And secondly, for sustainability and for environmental reasons, you should know where your tea is coming from. Are the people looking after the environment where they're growing the tea? Are they using natural resources? How many people are being employed? Are they being looked after? So those questions, I think, as modern responsible human beings, we should be very concerned with. And last not least is we have this fantastic program in the Tea Garden, which I think is also unique in the world. It's called the Cattle Lending Program. Because we don't use any external sort of chemicals or any additives, we have to rely heavily on the quality of the soil to be good for the production of the tea plants. So we need a lot of fertilizer. So when we started, at some point, we realized we were having too many cows. It was already over 500 cows that we were having in the farm because we needed the cow manure to fertilize the land. But the idea was not to become a dairy farm. So what we started doing was a cow lending program. So we'd lend the cows to the men and women in the village. And the idea was they can keep the cow, they can keep the milk the cow produces, and they can keep it for 2 years. And if they can show us that they are able to look after the cow, but repay us back with the manure every day, so the waste, we will go and collect the waste from their houses. And if they can do it successfully for 2 years, they get to keep the cow and they can apply for a second cow. What's very fascinating is it worked only with the women. The men we lent to, they invariably lost the cows or somehow just weren't able to look after them. So the women have become very independently successful. Some women have more than 10 cows in their houses. They sell the milk to the market. There's some of the milk we also buy. And then we just take the fertilizers and they have small businesses that's going to grow very well. Now, at some point, the cow lending program became so successful. We have so much of the cow manure that even the garden is over full with it. So what we've done is we've created a biogas plant, a small biogas plant inside the garden, which is now actively producing electricity, which supports the village around the garden.
And we must talk about books now, because at Tetulia there will be a special bookshelf curated by a writer, an actor. And the first one is it by Tilda Swinton, right?
That's right.
Tell us a bit more. That's right. Quite interesting.
So, you know, we believe that tea and books go well together. They should always be slowing down your busy pace of life. You pick up a physical book and you have a cup of tea, you already feel relaxed. You're already meditative. We're trying to sort of instill that belief back into the culture of that we have. And Tilda Swinton is a friend of ours. She went to the tea garden last year. She's actually coming back this year to visit again. And she loves our tea. And she suggested the idea of having a bookshelf inside the tea shop. So right now we have it already. It's called the Living Bookshelf, a name she gave. And she curated a section of it, basically the books she thinks you should read before you die. And then we also, she invited other authors who've been to the literary festival that Tetulia sponsors. So we've been sponsoring a festival called the Dhaka Literary Festival for the last 8 years. And we've had various authors, Nobel Prize winners, Booker winners, different kinds of actors, musicians, filmmakers, all been to the festival. It's like a literary plus arts festival once a year, every November. And they are all friends of Tetulia, so they're coming into the shop and curating their own sections of the bookshelf. So I think instead of having just a bookshelf with just random books that I may like or my staff may like, I think this is a more interesting way to curate it. The idea behind a living bookshelf is it changes like a living person. So every 3-4 months, those authors would come back, or we may have a new name coming back and putting up the books and the suggesting books that we should stock there. And the idea is you come in, you can read, you can see what books people are choosing, who's reading what. And then if you want to buy, you can buy. But the idea isn't really to sell the books. The idea is actually to encourage you to read.
Well, that's fascinating. And also, if someone goes to Tetulia, they can also have tea cocktails, right? Tell us a bit more. What's a tea cocktail? Which one would you recommend, for example?
I think it's a fun way of looking at tea.
Yeah.
Because I believe tea in the UK, sadly, has become very twee and very domesticated. Mm. People think tea is something you don't pay to have outside. Or you go for a high tea experience, an afternoon tea where you have scones and you go for a cream tea experience. We are neither. We are not domesticated. We are nor a cream tea place. What we are saying is you try tea in the different forms and you see the different complexities the flavors can bring. So one of the ideas we had was having tea cocktails. So we have a menu just doing tea cocktails. We're starting with just two cocktails, but we'll increase the menu very soon. And I really like the mojito, the tea mojito we have. It's a very interesting take on mojito, basically. But then there is another one with lemongrass. And I mean, we have actually a book full of tea cocktails that we've created in the US. We'll have a UK version soon. And in the evenings, you can have a mocktail or a cocktail. Just see how we make it. We can give you the recipe if you like.
Do you think some people are turning to tea these days, or do you think it's still quite hard to compete with coffee?
I think, first of all, it's two different markets, but I think more and more people are taking interest in tea just because of the various health benefits, which are now very clearly evident. And coffee gives you that instant high, the boost of caffeine, and you feel great for the next sort of 15, 20 minutes or half an hour, which is great if you're, you know, on a fast-paced life, which most of us have in London. But you immediately after an hour, you feel this slump and you often crave for something else then. And it's not a great feeling then. So you probably have another coffee then. And then you have too much caffeine and the body can only take so much. Whereas tea will give you the slow burn, as in like slow boost of your caffeine, because it also has caffeine. And then I must say, talk about the Bengal Builders, because we're talking about coffee. So that's our sort of competition with coffee. We have made almost coffee strength tea. So it's black tea, but it's kind of roasted heavily. So the caffeine level is very high. It's as much as a cup of coffee would be having. And you can use milk with it, different kinds of milk with it. And then it'll be like your breakfast, because I find most people skip breakfast and have a latte or a flat white. So you can try our Bengal Builders in the morning and it should give you the same effect.
And that's Asan Akbar, who is the founder of Teatulia, talking there to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Well, as we come to the end of this edition of Sunday Brunch, that focus of the global commemorations of the anniversary, the centenary of the signing of the armistice, the focus is now shifting to London. As we look at the monitors here in the studio, we can see leaders of Britain's political parties and leaders from the Commonwealth, along with members of the royal family and faith leaders and everyone else, gathering at the cenotaph, where a moment from now they will observe 2 minutes silence in honour of those killed in that conflict. That, though, wraps up this edition of Sunday Brunch, produced by George McDonough, studio managed by Sarah Miles. Mariana Laglaster was our researcher. It's the sessions of Midori House after the news, and later on, a Monocle Weekly. From me, Paul Osborne. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.